So then, we continue midway, roughly, through chapter 2, self-consecration. Concentration is indeed the first condition of any yoga, but it is an all-receiving concentration that is the very nature of the integral yoga. So you're familiar with the idea of concentration in the practice of yoga, going back to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, where it's the sixth element in the Eightfold Path. The term concentration predates that, of course. It goes back to the, at least to the Taittiriya Aranyaka, is important in the Mahabharata. You may remember, if we can wander away for a minute, the story about Arjuna when they were asked to practice archery in the forest, and the teacher sets a mottled vulture up in a branch in a tree and asks all his student archers to take aim and fire at it, but ask them first, what did they see? The idea is to strike it and knock the head off the vulture. And so the students reply, well, I see you, my teacher, I see all others here, I see the tree, I see the bird. And so answered them all. And they all fired and they all missed. Arjuna came, finally, at the end. And he said, and you, Arjuna, what do you see? Only the head of the bird. You see nothing else? I see only the head. And when he fired, he struck it, because his concentration was perfect and unbroken. The idea on concentration is that you dwell upon, you dwell within, you eliminate the distance between, you focus. Here he describes it as the condition for any successful yoga. In the Yoga Sutras, you first establish a posture, a seat. Then, when that posture is immobile, you move on and you establish rhythmic breath. It's deep, it's fluid, unceasing. You start to move from asana and pranayama to pratyahara, drawing your mind, your attention away from the call of the senses. You're going inside. You focus upon these elements of nature. As you withdraw your attention, you become composed. You practice deepening your awareness until it can fix upon an idea or upon an image, because some people are visual and some people are auditory. So usually a mantra or an image, the Ishta Devata, is visualized. And you focus upon that until there is nothing else. And that focusing, that concentration, is dharana. When your concentration becomes entire and unbroken, then what you get is meditation. Now, nothing wanders. You can live inside that interior dimension without anything distracting you. So it is dharana that gives you the power of meditation, is the concentration. You won't be able to concentrate long at the beginning, and Sri Aurobindo will go into this. But with time, with effort, Like a weak muscle that becomes strong with exercise, you'll develop that power until it becomes unconquerable. Nothing can resist the power of concentration. So here Sri Aurobindo differentiates it in this very first sentence, an all-receiving concentration. He already hints at what is necessary in the integral yoga. All-receiving, that means widely embracing, not blocking. But he's suggesting that it is going to be this in-drinking, as if all rivers are pouring into an ocean that will become the perfect concentration. A separate strong fixing of the thought, of the emotions, or of the will on a single idea, object, state, inner movement, or principle is no doubt a frequent need here also. But this is only a subsidiary, helpful process. A wide, massive opening, a harmonized concentration of the whole being in all its parts and through all its powers upon the One who is the All, is the larger action of this yoga, without which it cannot achieve its purpose. And again, Sri Aurobindo is writing from his own deep personal experience, but without calling upon it. And this was the body of his realization when he was confined in the Alipur jail, because he became open to the One who was everywhere. Now that One revealed itself not to be an abstract, sheer existence, void of personality, but indeed full of personal being, and in fact had instantiated itself in all beings. The One person was all beings and at the core of all persons. He continues, for it is the consciousness that rests in the One and that acts in the All to which we aspire. It is this that we seek to impose on every element of our being and on every movement of our nature. This wide and concentrated totality is the essential character of the sadhana, and its character must determine its practice. So sadhana is the discipline that will take us to that experience, and we have to achieve this wide, this immense concentration, so that this is what we perceive, the One, the All, everywhere. This goes back not only to the Gita, but even farther back to the Isha Upanishad, verses 6, 7, 8. He who sees the self in all existences and all existences in the self, etc. But even though the concentration of all the being on the divine is the character of the yoga, yet is our being too complex a thing to be taken up easily and at once, as if we were taking up the world in a pair of hands and set in its entirety to a single task. Man, in his effort at self-transcendence, has usually to seize on some one spring or some powerful leverage in the complicated machine that his nature is. This spring or lever he touches in preference to others and uses it to set the machine in motion towards the end that he has in view. In his choice, it is always nature itself that should be his guide. But here, it must be nature at her highest and widest in him, not at her lowest or in some limiting movement. So there is going to be some predominant element of the nature which is stronger in one than the others. That you begin with, but not at a low level, at a high level. If you're going to work from vital energy, it's got to be from the higher vital. If you're going to work from the mind, you've got to lift it up at least to the rational element or beyond. into that which borders the infinite, the higher mind. In her lower vital activities, it is desire that nature takes as her most powerful leverage. But the distinct character of man is that he is a mental being, not a merely vital creature. As he can use his thinking mind and will to restrain and correct his life impulses, so too he can bring in the action of a still higher, luminous mentality, aided by the deeper soul in him, the psychic being, and supersede by these greater and purer motive powers the domination of the vital and sensational force that we call desire. He can entirely master or persuade it and offer it up for transformation to its divine master. This higher mentality and this deeper soul, the psychic element in man, are the two grappling hooks by which the divine can lay hold upon his nature. Much of this paragraph Sri Aurobindo rewrote from the original Arya to deepen this and to place firmly in it the emphasis on discovering the psychic being within. So you can primarily be awake to the higher consciousness through the elements of the mind that are open to it, or you can move from within. These are the two easiest paths. Finding the soul, being open to the higher consciousness. The higher mind in man is something other, loftier, purer, vaster, more powerful than the reason or logical intelligence. The animal is a vital and sensational being. Man, it is said, is distinguished from the animal by the possession of reason. But that is a very summary, a very imperfect and misleading account of the matter. For reason is only a particular and limited utilitarian and instrumental activity that proceeds from something much greater than itself, from a power that dwells in an ether more luminous, wider, illimitable. The true and ultimate, as distinguished from the immediate or intermediate importance of our observing, reasoning, inquiring, judging intelligence, is that it prepares the human being for the right reception and right action of a light from above, which must progressively replace in him the obscure light from below that guides the animal. Now, Sri Aurobindo, you might think, is conferring upon us awakening to the supermind, but Sri Aurobindo's goals, if you remember from the Life Divine, were more modest. We move from the rational mind into the powers of the intuitive consciousness, and from there, having caught that ray of truth, widen to the full luminosity of the solar consciousness that is the supramental. And between intuition and supermind is all that golden lid which he characterizes as the overmind, discoverable both in the Veda and in the Isha Upanishad. The latter also has a rudimentary reason. Well, here he's talking about the animal. The latter also has a rudimentary reason, a kind of thought, a soul, a will, and keen emotions. Even though less developed, its psychology is yet the same in kind as man's. But all these capacities in the animal are automatically moved and strictly limited, almost even constituted by the lower nervous being. All animal perceptions, sensibilities, activities are ruled by nervous and vital instincts, cravings, needs, satisfactions, of which the nexus is the life impulse and vital desire. Man, too, is bound, but less bound, to this automatism of the vital nature. I think I'll pause there and say a word in defense of animals. Obviously, Sri Aurobindo will describe here that the human species is below that higher consciousness into which we will evolve, and superior to the animal consciousness dominated by materiality and vital instincts, which so dominates them according to the human view. The human view unaware of how its own appetites drive it. But Sri Aurobindo and the mother didn't just have people around them in the Sri Aurobindo ashram. They also had dogs and cats and visits from monkeys and all sorts of beings, because India is alive with creatures. And they welcomed them all. And you probably know of Sri Aurobindo's wonderful sonnet in which he describes the four-footed Brahman, the cat, in his poem, Despair on the Staircase. If you haven't read it, you should go read it. It's charming. It'll melt your heart. But there were many occasions where Sri Aurobindo closely observed animals. He watched and talked about this in his conversations in the 1920s. Dogs, for instance, figure things out rationally, just like a human might. Finding a door closed, the dog stops, thinks, and says, "Ah, I think I have another solution," and goes around a different way, finds a door, is able to push it open, I think, with his nose, and goes into the house and gains access. And Sri Aurobindo said, this is precisely how a human mind would operate. No difference. Also noted that several dogs were not brutish, but had psychic characteristics, that in fact the soul was evident in them. Simply, it had not arrived at individuated form. You know also that the mother worked with cats, worked with dogs, but particularly with cats, because she found them receptive to an influence that she could impart to encourage a rapid development of the psychic possibility in them, so that they could be lifted to a human body in their next incarnation. And she reported success, sometimes by taking that psychic essence and combining it with a friendly, affined being already having attained psychic-hood, and in that association develop it, sometimes simply by the mere leap into a new status of being. Now, it's difficult for an animal to get there and sustain that. And so she wasn't going to take a risky experiment which would result in a costly failure. So she was very careful about how she prepared. And you're probably aware that she often sat in meditation with cats. Obviously, Kiki, the famous cat, who would sit and sway in meditation and make meows while she was having experiences. These higher consciousnesses were descending, and as they descended, she would be receptive to them. They might be too powerful for her, and so they would make her rock. They would make her meow. Because perfectly, we should be able to allow an ocean to come into us and only exhibit what we wish to from that filling up. We should be able to contain it and not betray its presence. Or we should be able to dance and sing if the soul, if the divine in us moves to do it. So I encourage you to look at your companions, human and otherwise, and see what you might do by living in your own soul more powerfully to educe that element from them. I don't promise this is the only time I'm going to talk about that. I feel like I've forgotten something, so I may come back to it. So, back to this. Man, too, is bound but less bound to this automatism of the vital nature. Man can bring an enlightened will, an enlightened thought, and enlightened motions to the difficult work of his self-development. He can, more and more, subject to these more conscious and reflecting guides the inferior function of desire. In proportion as he can thus master and enlighten his lower self, he is man and no longer an animal. When he can begin to replace desire altogether by a still greater enlightened thought and sight and will in touch with the infinite, consciously subject to a diviner will than his own, linked to a more universal and transcendent knowledge, he has commenced the ascent towards the Superman. He is on his upward march towards the divine. It is then in the highest mind of thought and light and will, or it is in the inner heart of deepest feeling and emotion, that we must first center our consciousness. In either of them, or if we are capable, in both together. And use that as our leverage to lift the nature wholly towards the divine. So where are we capable of experiencing this oneness and holding fast to it? Dharana. If we're capable in more than one element of the being, then great. If we begin with one, then secure it and let it, through a sort of divine osmosis, breathe its fragrance into the rest of the being, so that that part too, that previously didn't have that sense of oneness, begins to feel it. If it suffuses out from the heart into the mind, well and good. If it starts in the mind and moves into the heart and awakens it, well and good. If it seizes both parts of the being together, because that person is so evolved and developed, even better. The concentration of an enlightened thought, will, and heart, turned in unison towards one vast goal of our knowledge, one luminous and infinite source of our action, one imperishable object of our emotion, is the starting point of the yoga. So, have a look at Bhagavad Gita in the last chapter, the 65th verse, shloka, in which he describes the experience of the one in all three centers of us, in the mind, in the emotions, in the active consecration of our works. Manmanaha, madbhakta, madhyaji, mam namaskuru. And the object of our seeking must be the very fount of the light which is growing in us, the very origin of the force which we are calling to move our members. Our one objective must be the divine himself, to whom, knowingly or unknowingly, something always aspires in our secret nature. There must be a large, many-sided, yet single concentration of the thought on the idea, the perception, the vision, the awakening touch, the soul's realization of the one divine. There must be a flaming concentration of the heart on the seeking of the all and eternal, and when once we have found him, a deep plunging and immersion in the possession and ecstasy of the all-beautiful. There must be a strong and immovable concentration of the will on the attainment and fulfillment of all that the divine is, and a free and plastic opening of it to all that he intends to manifest in us. This is the triple way of the yoga. This, again, was largely added in his revision, bringing full attention to the awakening of the psychic fire and the experience of the all-beautiful. But on that which as yet we know not, how shall we concentrate? And yet, we cannot know the divine unless we have achieved this concentration of our being upon him. A concentration which culminates in a living realization and the constant sense of the presence of the One in ourselves and in all of which we are aware is what we mean in yoga by knowledge and the effort after knowledge. So it is identity of experience. This is that. That is this. Purnamadaha, Purnamidam. There is no difference. It is the same one. So he calls us first to the constant experience, which is endlessly renewed, which is what we call realization. Realization is not the experience which then ends and which you have to ignite again. Realization is permanent. It is always in the background. It may not be at the forefront of the consciousness, but as Sri Aurobindo describes in his correspondence, even if the yogi senses that there is something into which he is drifting, which is external, he pauses and looks within and goes back into that never lost, solid, vast experience of the self, of Brahman, of the divine. It is not enough to devote ourselves by the reading of scriptures or by the stress of philosophic reasoning to an intellectual understanding of the divine. For at the end of our long mental labor, we might know all that has been said of the eternal, possess all that can be thought about the infinite, and yet we might not know him at all. This intellectual preparation can indeed be the first stage in a powerful yoga, but it is not indispensable. It is not a step which all need or can be called upon to take to develop a well-read philosophic mind is not the key to yogic realization, to understanding the spirit which is behind phenomena. Even if you study it, you're probably aware of St. Thomas Aquinas, the great Catholic theologian who dominated theology for the Roman Catholic Church for centuries after his passing. Had an experience at the end of his life which left him absolutely shaken. He came into contact with that and it shattered all of his intellectual equipment, his carefully derived philosophy, concatenated, clear, fell to the floor. And he said, I see that all that I have done is nothing compared to that. You find that in a number of experiences that mystics have had across the world. Plotinus, in Islam as well, in Buddhism. The thinking of it is different from the experiencing of it. So again, this intellectual preparation can indeed be the first stage in a powerful yoga, but it is not indispensable. It is not a step which all need or can be called upon to take. Yoga would be impossible, except for a very few, if the intellectual figure of knowledge arrived at by the speculative or meditative reason were its indispensable condition or a binding preliminary. another example of the psychic efflorescence that carries you beyond all reasoning would be the example of Brother Lawrence, the French monk who came through the awakening of his psychic being into touch with that. Regardless of the terminology, that was what was real behind his movement upwards and inwards. All that the light from above asks of us, that it may begin its work, is a call from the soul and a sufficient point of support in the mind. This support can be reached through an insistent idea of the divine in the thought, a corresponding will in the dynamic parts, an aspiration of faith, a need in the heart. Any one of these may lead or predominate if all cannot move in unison or in an equal rhythm. The idea may be, and must in the beginning, be inadequate. The aspiration may be narrow and imperfect, the faith poorly illumined, or even, as not surely founded on the rock of knowledge, fluctuating, uncertain, easily diminished. Often even it may be extinguished and need to be lit again with difficulty, like a torch in a windy pass. But if once there is a resolute self-consecration from deep within, if there is an awakening to the soul's call, these inadequate things can be a sufficient instrument for the divine purpose. Therefore, the wise have always been unwilling to limit man's avenues towards God. They would not shut against his entry even the narrowest portal, the lowest and darkest postern, the humblest wicket gate. Any name, any form, any symbol, any offering has been held to be sufficient if there is the consecration along with it. For the divine knows himself in the heart of the seeker and accepts the sacrifice. You remember the Gita, even a blade of grass, even a cup of water is sufficient if offered from the purity of your heart. I accept it, Krishna tells Arjuna. But still, the greater and wider the moving idea force behind the consecration, the better for the seeker. His attainment is likely to be fuller and more ample. If we are to attempt an integral yoga, it will be as well to start with an idea of the divine that is itself integral. There should be an aspiration in the heart, wide enough for a realization without any narrow limits. Not only should we avoid a sectarian religious outlook, but also all one-sided philosophical conceptions, which try to shut up the ineffable in a restricting mental formula. The dynamic conception or impelling sense with which our yoga can best set out would be naturally the idea, the sense of a conscious, all-embracing, but all-exceeding infinite. Our uplook must be to a free, all-powerful, perfect, and blissful one and oneness in which all beings move and live and through which all can meet and become one. Goes back to the Isha Upanishad. Goes back to his own life divine, where he describes that being beyond all conception, beyond all positive note, that is exceeding even the reality of pure being, which can't be caught even in that, but which expresses itself as a transcendence, is expressed in the universality around us in the world, but also exists in each individual. This eternal will be at once personal and impersonal in his self-revelation and touch upon the soul. So whether one is called like the drop to the ocean, from the alone to the alone in Plotinus's Neoplatonic philosophy, or in the many ways that Sri Ramakrishna gained access to the divine, whether impersonal or personal, whether a god or a goddess, whether that Brahman which transcends all manifestation and transient things, it is the same. He is personal because he is the conscious divine, the infinite person who casts some broken reflection of himself in the myriad divine and undivine personalities of the universe. He is impersonal because he appears to us as an infinite existence, consciousness, and ananda, and because he is the fount, base, and constituent of all existences and all energies, the very material of our being and mind and life and body, our spirit and our matter. The thought concentrating on him must not merely understand in an intellectual form that he exists, or conceive of him as an abstraction, a logical necessity. It must become a seeing thought, able to meet him here as the inhabitant in all, realize him in ourselves, watch and take hold on the movement of his forces. He is the one existence. He is the original and universal delight that constitutes all things and exceeds them. He is the one infinite consciousness that composes all consciousnesses and informs all their movements. He is the one illimitable being who sustains all action and experience. His will guides the evolution of things towards their yet unrealized but inevitable aim and plenitude. To him the heart can consecrate itself, approach him as the supreme beloved, beat and move in him as in a universal sweetness of love and a living sea of delight. For his is the secret joy that supports the soul in all its experiences and maintains even the errant ego in its ordeals and struggles till all sorrow and suffering shall cease. His is the love and the bliss of the infinite divine lover who is drawing all things by their own path towards his happy oneness. On him, the will can unalterably fix as the invisible power that guides and fulfills it and as the source of its strength. In the impersonality, this actuating power is a self-illumined force that contains all results and calmly works until it accomplishes in the personality an all-wise and omnipotent master of the yoga whom nothing can prevent from leading it to its goal. This is the faith with which the seeker has to begin his seeking and endeavor. For in all his effort here, but most of all in his effort towards the unseen, mental man must perforce proceed by faith. When the realization comes, the faith divinely fulfilled and completed will be transformed into an eternal flame of knowledge. Bhagavad Gita, final chapter, verses 54, 55, 61. So that's a good place again to break. We'll take up, I think, the remainder of the chapter next time. So here's a passage from Savitri in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings. This is in Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. In every hour loosed from the quiver of time, there rose a song of new discovery, a bow twangs hum of young experiment. Each day was a spiritual romance, as if he was born into a bright new world. Adventure leaped an unexpected friend, and danger brought a keen, sweet tang of joy. Each happening was a deep experience. There were high encounters, epic colloquies, and counsels came couched in celestial speech, and honeyed pleadings breathed from occult lips to help the heart to yield to rapture's call. And sweet temptations stole from beauty's realms, and sudden ecstasies from a world of bliss. It was a region of wonder and delight. All now his bright clairaudience could receive. A contact thrilled of mighty unknown things. Awakened to new unearthly closenesses, the touch replied to subtle infinities, and with a silver cry of opening gates, sight's lightnings leaped into the invisible. Ever his consciousness and vision grew. They took an ampler sweep, a loftier flight. He passed the border marked for matter's rule, and passed the zone where thought replaces life. Out of this world of signs, suddenly he came into a silent self where world was not, and looked beyond into a nameless vast. These symbol figures lost their right to live. All tokens dropped our sense can recognize. There the heart beat no more at body's touch. There the eyes gaze no more on beauty's shape. In rare and lucent intervals of hush, into a signless region he could soar, packed with the deep contents of formlessness, where world was into a single being wrapped, and all was known by the light of identity, and spirit was its own self-evidence. The Supreme's gaze looked out through human eyes and saw all things and creatures as itself and knew all thought and word as its own voice. There unity is too close for search and clasp, and love is a yearning of the one for the one, and beauty is a sweet difference of the same, and oneness is the soul of multitude. Namaste. Jai Ma.